Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining Voices from the Field, in which we bring you the insights and perspectives of those on the ground working hard to bring transformative change to child welfare to keep children safe and strengthen families. Today's conversation will be about birth and foster parent partnerships, an innovative approach where birth and foster parents work together to support one another and facilitate reunification as soon as possible. This idea came about at a 2018 convening in Seattle, where a group of 32 birth and foster parents came together and talked through what a partnership like this would look like and brainstormed some practice and policies that would impact how foster and birth parents could interact with one another to achieve reunification. Our guests today, Corey Best, birth parent, and Amanda Williams, foster parent, were at that meeting. They will tell us about the importance of birth and foster parent relationship building and how they are working together to spread this practice shift in Florida and across the country. Corey and Amanda, thank you so much for being here with us today. Can you start by telling us why a strong partnership between foster and birth parents is important and what the benefits are, not only for the child, but for the birth and foster parents as well?
Sure thing. I choose to speak from the parent perspective and also, you know, from a male parenting perspective. So often fathers are disappeared in our systems for whatever reasons. There are lots of variables. We bring our own levels of understanding of what a dad should be based on our own upbringing. There's a lot that goes on behind it. But really, more than anything, I think the greatest benefit for the parent is a sense of belonging. Often, parents who have been exposed to the child welfare system, where there needs to be more intrusive involvement, meaning foster care placement has to be sort of phased out, or there's a plan in place, that means we're looking 6 to 18 months before reunification occurs. There were some things that were going on before then, which parents often have been isolated. So we know that social isolation is a petri dish for a greater neglect and or abuse. When parents are partnered with a foster parent who not only cares for the best interest of the child, but realize that a part of the best interest of the child is for the parent to be healthy if the goal is definitely reunification. And a sense of belonging and a part of something is a way, I would say, to empower a parent to continue to honor their role as the parent in the child's life, but recognizing that the separation is as temporary as it possibly can be, is the ultimate reward for the parent. Another benefit I believe as a result of the partnership is that due to isolation, due to the lack of support, due to the view of the system and also the positional power, the foster parent is in a unique position to not only challenge the status quo, but also have the fortitude and the strength to recognize that this is a relationship that's forming and to be supportive to parent, to say that, you know, I recognize that we all make mistakes, but in this relationship, we're going to fail forward if need be. Mistakes are not to be rubbed in, they're to be rubbed out. That I won't let you fall too far, right? You have a safe and supportive network of individuals who care for you and your child. It just so happens that whatever stage of life you're in right now, your child will be in my care, but he or she is still your child. So affirmations, reinforcing the role of the parent really supplants that in our systems. And it helps us to see things differently, again, because the view of foster parents are they're deeply connected to the system. So when you have someone who's the face of the system, for lack of a better word, they begin to change the perception for other parents in the system. And that's a huge benefit because in oral culture, we tend to tell people, what good things are happening in the systems, right? So there's a lot of benefits there for parents. What do you think, Amanda?
I absolutely agree. I think a lot of the same for foster parents. I think that we are changing cultures and we're changing communities and working together at libraries. And I see now people meeting up that you might not have seen sitting together before and reading books to kids together and having that interaction where who the child calls mom doesn't offend anybody because we've already talked about it and we've already worked through that issue. And if the child, and I will call you dad, no matter who the child calls dad, because you are still dad. And that those labels are titles, but also just labels of the actions that you're doing during the day. When I talk to foster parents about why they should do this, one of the main things that we talk about, because it resonates with them, and hopefully it becomes bigger, is that the more connected you are and the more family building you're doing, the more likely you get to remain and watch this child grow up through an amazing reunification. And we have stayed connected to so many of the youth that have been in our home and have been to graduations and no weddings yet. Thankfully, it hasn't been quite that long. But lots of different life events where we're supporting the whole family. And it has been an incredible benefit. Because nobody, and I mean really, no matter why you come to foster care, what your calling is, nobody wants to love someone that lives with them and never see them again. And I think that that's true for quote-unquote birth parents, foster parents, all different parents. Nobody wants to love someone for a period of time and lose them. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And if we remember that on both sides, we will care more for the other and what they've gone through. So for me, the biggest thing, if we're trying to get systems and agencies excited about this, is when we see this working best, we see lower rates of reentry into care. We see youth who are not going into adulthood and then having a connection with the system. Our children are able to stay in their home. We see positive relationships forming. One of the most exciting things, we had a young girl who lived with us maybe almost 10 years ago, who reunified with her mom. And she got pregnant, and when she had the baby, just based on her history and what was in her medical records, DCF was called immediately. And because she knew us and trusted us and supported us, we were able to be on her safety plan, and the child never spent a night out of her home. Mm. So these relationships and knowing that it's the whole family, if I had ostracized her or stopped talking to them when she reunified, if I hadn't supported them through that whole process, that child would have been in the system too. So exciting systems with this whole legacy of change. We're changing generations, not just one situation.
Wow, those are some amazing benefits. So birth and foster parents working together is a fairly innovative idea and not your standard practice in most agencies. And we know how difficult it can be to achieve a culture shift in a large agency when people are accustomed to working in a certain way. What have been some of the barriers that you've encountered that have impacted the ability to activate this collaboration in the communities that you work in?
The greatest barriers is it's tough. It's really tough work to know that something is valuable, to become a neutral advocate, to recognize that when we think of the waves and how innovation and change happens, that ultimately there are certain people who are laggards. Then there are some people who adapt quickly, early, right? And then those individuals who are slow to come to the party, so to speak, are the ones who really want to see if it works, right? So some of the barriers are the systemic barriers, the lack of urgency to do something different, the fear of experimentation, that we have to know through data, through quantitative evaluation, that this works. But we are a group of subjective beings. None of us fit in little neat boxes. Risk tolerance or lack thereof is also another barrier because, you know, depending upon why a child comes into care, we are afraid or risk averse, as some would say, that certain things would happen. Even at the case level, that in certain jurisdictions or states that it's considered a risk or a safety hazard if mom, dad builds or establishes a relationship or visits on a day that's not ordered by the court, right? So we have a lot of man-made systemic barriers in play that I feel we could definitely sort of jump over or just push through. The other barrier I really find with having this as a laser focus, as the way of being, I truly believe that all of us get up every day and say we're going to do the best job we possibly can. I don't sense ill intent in our system, but I think that just by the nature of our punitive system, we are very reactive. So we have a front door of child welfare that's bringing in so many children. It's hard to focus on relationships before services, before we get beyond rescue, save mentality. So I think a lot of our challenges is, again, at the community level, at the larger system level, that prevents us from focusing on healthier relationships in order to, when foster care is a need, in order to nurture casework, good, wholesome social work, in order to nurture and teach foster parents and birth parents how to see one another differently. There's a training. I mean, you know, there's one training we can go to that'll teach us about biases or what have you, but it's the immersion. It's the practice that really gets us there. And I think that organizations overall are the ones that nurture that well-being, that nurture that sort of family-centered, family-fostering environments, right? So leadership, risk aversion, and I'm curious about, you know, from Amanda's perspective, what she sees as well.
I think risk aversion is one of the biggest things. And this expectation when you have either a pilot or the one family who's doing it, that if it doesn't go well, then it doesn't go well. Mm-hmm. And so you put this one case and this one parent and in such a high level of expectation. And of course it isn't going to go well. Like, that's just not even fair to do to one situation, one case, one person. And I think not giving humans, all parents, the benefit of relapse, of having bad days, of not doing well, of needing another chance, we all have that. But yet when you're looking in this siloed microscope at this one situation, it looks disastrous. So the risk aversion in us says, well, we just can't do this again. This program won't work. And that's not reality. That's not how humans work. That's not how life works.
Yes, that is very true. Let's expand on that a little. Are there any specific policies or practices in place in the child welfare system that you've come across that hinder this approach from being adopted? And what kinds of policies and practices actually encourage and promote it?
So I will share different levels of my experience as a birth parent, and I'll start with first my experience been exposed to the child welfare system due to neglect. So from my understanding, and this was a long while ago, 2003, 2004, so things have definitely changed since then. There were definitely no written policies in place that said dad, mom could not interact with the foster parent. The policy is an assumed policy. It's this pervasive elephant in the room that we adhere to, but there's no standards of practice that says we can't elevate that partnership. Also in my work as a peer, so I've worked in various aspects of our system and our systems change efforts. So as a peer mentor working in direct service and also an advocate for child welfare reform, a few years ago, I partnered with a colleague of mine from high school who actually worked at LexisNexis at the time. And I asked just for a favor, can you like do, this was because of the birth and foster parent relationship. We were doing some policy scans to see what was happening in states that prevent this relationship from from being nurtured. And there were absolutely zero policies in the country that came back to say, if you cannot establish a relationship with your parent. Now, we drill deeper and we look for policies that encouraged the relationship, because we wanted to look at it from a positive perspective, right? Okay, so if there's none that prevent it, there must be one or two that promotes it. And we couldn't find any of those either. So it tells me that the things we focus on become bigger. And we focus on separating families, meaning not increasing the relationship or nurturing the relationship internally inside of our agencies. So the more we can focus on how might child welfare agencies, leaders, caseworkers, foster parents, and parents establish healthy relationships while kids are in the care of many times strangers, how do we nurture that relationship?
One of the biggest barriers, and that ties into all of this and into how do we do this, is how do you have those authentic conversations about racial disparity, and how is your child who grew up in their home living in my home in a fairly white upper middle class neighborhood, and what is that doing to their culture and their mindset and their identity, and how do you relate to me coming from different places? And I think that is one of the biggest barriers, because I can talk all day to a family about how I feel about the racial barriers and racial inequality, but it doesn't feel authentic, even though I'm being my authentic self, right? Right? That's a hard conversation. One of the things that moves that needle is having these birth parent partnerships where a birth parent is a peer mentor to other birth parents and can go in and say, look, I know she sounds snobby or uppity or whatever, but really she's being authentic. That's really who she is. Like, this is as good as it gets. Work with her, this is how it can help, and helping break down some of those barriers. You can't get that in an icebreaker. You can't get that on a one-on-one conversation with your caseworker who removed your child. You need someone who has lived experience to do that with you. When we're recruiting new parents to come and join us and be foster parents, you have to also tell them you're a support, not a replacement. The goal is short term, and that is not one of those short-term, but maybe you'll adopt eventually, or short-term, but eventually someone will stay. It's the goal is short-term, period. And I think it is hard for me, and I am a long-term foster parent. I do have some adoptions. I consider myself a reunification parent. And I think it is hard when you get to those sessions and those recruitments that say, you know, I'm so excited about reunification, but I'll adopt if I have to. But if you go into it with the whole goal and the messaging and the mindset of, I am so excited to get this child with their family, you will do anything, even at that year mark, even at that 2 year mark, and know that that bond of family is vital. Mm-hmm. And it's hard. I mean, I had a child recently that the system was so intent on her staying in our home. That was their goal for her. And she had a grandmother who was willing and able and ready, with some barriers. We had to stand up in court and say in front of the child, we will not adopt her. We love her forever, but we will not adopt her if there is a breathing family member that can take her.
That is such a powerful example, and that would be a huge shift in mindset for many foster parents. And speaking of shifting perspectives, how do we bring the caseworkers and other foster child welfare professionals to change their own thinking to promote this as an agency-wide practice?
One thing that is really hard is we are able to rely on fear very much, unless we're encouraged not to. So when you come and you start fostering and the caseworker says, it's okay if you're scared of this family, I'll protect you. You protect the child, I'll protect you. Let all of your information go through me. It is hard then to meet that person and have this authentic relationship. But if we start off in a different, more strengths-based area and say, sure, I'll go with you and introduce you to this person that I've already met, right? Because the caseworker most likely will have already met the family. Mm-hmm. You meet them, and then you have a normal relationship with normal boundaries. There are families that message me at midnight, and I don't respond because I don't have my phone on at midnight. I don't take it as an attack. They're not trying to harass me. They're thinking about their child at midnight. They can't sleep, and they sent me a message, and I don't respond. The next day, I might message back and say, oh, hey, I really go to bed at 10. Please don't message me after 10. Because that's what I would say to anybody, mm-hmm. right? And so I think trying to normalize, and so I do that a lot with caseworkers, with other families that I help mentor, talk a lot about how do we just normalize this relationship as a normal interaction, as normal as possible, between two adults who have something very special and precious between them.
You know, when I think about what we could do differently at the case level, so I'm grateful to have an opportunity to work with a lot of child welfare investigators, and in Florida, we're privatized in some county-run systems as well. So there are social workers and case managers that manage cases who have a greater opportunity than investigators to work with foster parents, right? And what I've learned is that practice dictates policy. So when we ask what caseworkers are effectively working to create opportunities for birth and foster parents to work together, to partner, to share ideas, we encourage leadership or supervisors to extract that best practice and try to make that become the norm. So we do that through SurveyMonkey, very simple, easy SurveyMonkey, just asking our trainees, you know, do you work with birth and foster parents and how does that look? From there, we try to encourage the understanding that one, we can't cookie cut every single thing, that each family is different in very unique ways. So how we're able to sort of become adaptive and flexible to the fact, to the ebbs and flows of life circumstances. Some families are angry, some are. Sometimes anger should be taken as a positive thing, because if there's no affect at all, maybe that's an issue. So, I mean, how do we think about, you know, when and how to build a healthy relationship? Back to my point, I think what caseworkers in certain parts of my state are recognizing is that there's no list of things that are going to create this one particular model. That if they encourage birth parents and foster parents to work together, that there is a great opportunity for some lifelong connections, that the positive outweighs the risk, that if we can view what's working well in families, magnify and build on strengths, that families are more receptive to that approach, that it's about relationships before services, and also allow the foster parent, since he or she recognizes, again, that positional authority they have is huge. So setting clear expectations from the very beginning, with just like with any other relationship that's established, I think we have a win-win situation.
What comes up when you are out in the field training foster parents and other child welfare professionals about birth and foster parent partnerships? What have been some of your responses when people claim that this type of relationship and practice approach just won't work?
There are a variety of perspectives in the room. And we observe that through nonverbal communication. Rarely do we get the one who says, well, no, that's never going to work. But we get we get challenged often after the workshop that I've tried this, that it didn't work. So what we try to encourage is when you're faced with the second step, the goal is not to change the parent. If we're speaking to a foster parent, the goal is not to change the parent. The goal is to do the work on you. So if you evaluate yourself at the end of the day and you say that I've treated John Doe with respect, cultural humility, I have advocated for him, and I recognize his race, his heritage, his ethnicity, and I value him still, and therefore he did not take what I was depositing into his life, you've done your job.
Yes.
You've done your job. Every day we encourage people to treat individuals with dignity. You've done your work. We cannot expect everyone to take the prescription that we're giving, but it's about human behavior and building relationships. More times than not, we see that this relationship, even in the most challenging times, when the relationship is based in a set of values and those practices are filtered through those values, the relationship blossoms. So in training, we have a lot of opportunity to really dive deeper. And what I've noticed most that comes out is the conversation about how we help shape kids of different backgrounds and races identity when children of color are placed with predominantly white families. So we've had white families approach us with a few questions about how do we do that. So that's a point of interest. And also the shared challenges that it's amazing, the shared challenges that parents have with the system, meaning the caseworkers or social workers, foster parents have the same sets of challenges, paperwork, court dates, no return phone calls. So how do we, look for some common ground and some similarities and even the struggle, right? Because the struggle is often the same where the system sort of snags where we want to go.
Yeah. Amanda. Yeah, it's been really interesting as we have been on our traveling roadshow. The things that people have been interested in have taken more time than our ability to get to the concrete ideas of what you could do. So we've restructured a lot because people really want to talk about myths. And foster parents in particular want to meet a birth parent who's doing well, because for many of us, once a child leaves your home, you don't talk to that birth parent again. You might see the child at something, but you don't get to sit down and say, how are you really doing? Are you still struggling with your addiction? Are you, did you maintain that job? Did you this? You're out of that role. So the ability to meet someone who has successfully navigated and is doing great and it's 10 years past their time in child welfare is like a miracle, or a light bulb goes off for people, and they have so many questions that we don't get past that.
So now I'm going to shift gears a little and ask you about what this model might look like if there was more of a focus on prevention, more of an upstream approach so that children don't need to come into foster care. And what would the role of foster parents be to support birth parents to ultimately prevent child welfare involvement?
There is a lot of movement to get us what we like to call further upstream to preventing children from coming into care, ultimately preventing maltreatment overall. And as we can cultivate birth and foster parent relationships and partnerships at the system and state level, I think, I choose to say emphatically that I believe that foster care overall should be the last call, not the first. I don't want callers to get the wrong impression that we're promoting foster care. I think that, when it's needed, it should be done much differently, because we know so much about what individuals need to feel connected, loved, and a sense of belonging. When we, in our systems and in our thinking, can catch up to the research, most of our systems are without intention, without ill will, promoting greater harm to our children overall than good, just what we know about research and brain science, right? And many of our families aren't the families that are really doing like horrific things to kids. So many of our families are struggling with everyday common needs, food, shelter, clothing, right? food, shelter, and clothing. So how can we become a pair, a partnership that really advocates for greater change? So basically, I know that as we're building something new, it's like scaffolding, right? Construction, right? There's going to be some dust, so we got to do a little work to clean up. But I think where our initial part of the conversation was what's happening in the evolutionary bucket. And I think that there's some greater work to be done as we cultivate relationships at the case level, build those lifelong connections, the family care, foster parents are in a position to really identify parents as champions, and parents and foster parents can become partner champions for ultimately prevention. So I wanted to make that distinction there, that I think we're on to something amazingly remarkable in our system once the messaging and the mindset is different. And I think that's just how we view humanity overall.
Right. Well, and I think you can't see me because this is recording, furiously shaking my head yes and agreeing with everything you're saying. And I think I struggle so much because we have this whole group of volunteers, right? Community volunteers who have said, I care about the welfare of children in my community. Foster parents who have stepped up from all different backgrounds saying, this matters to me. I am so passionate about this. And we're said, well, the best place to volunteer is to take children into your home. Why aren't we told the best place to help is a community resource center, the local library in a neighborhood? Take all of the food that you can to this place and sit and serve. Mm. How else can we be of service? And so one of the things that I love about my community is we're doing that. In Gainesville, Florida, we have a community of hope, and it is absolutely incredible. And we are doing that primary prevention work, and we are not requiring, but asking and humbly asking foster parents to come and participate, not as foster parents, but as community activists, community volunteers that come and sit at the prevention center and check people in. That's where we need to put more effort, is how do we use all of this manpower, desire, and passion in a prevention model? And you and I will make it work. It'll happen one day.
The Gainesville Community of Hope is such a great example. There's amazing primary prevention work happening there. So my last question for you is this. What is your advice for a child welfare leader interested in promoting a birth and foster parent partnership program? Where would they even begin?
There is not a place that we shouldn't have both of us together. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't have to be Corey and I. I know you're all probably listening to this recording and thinking, I'm just going to get the two of them. There are capable birth parents and foster parents in your state waiting for you to help elevate them and train them and get them ready to be the next leaders in your state, in your county, in your city, and have them on your board of directors, have them at the next meeting. Don't just involve them at their own personal case level. They need to be involved at every level of the state, and they need to be respected as professionals. They need to be hired, they need to be paid. And they need to be treated with dignity and humanity.
Corey and Amanda, thank you so much for your time and sharing your thoughts with us. Do you have any last comments to share?
Is I really challenge people to call them parent initiatives and to take out the preceding word. So this is not about birth parents, foster parents, kinship parents. We should be having parent dialogues and parent interactions, mm-hmm. and it should include the gamut. So when you're having a parent listening panel or you're having a group that's meeting in your local area, don't label people. Let's have an authentic real time where you're getting to know a human and not their label profession, whatever you want to call it.
And thank you for reminding me of that as well. We do have those conversations, and I think that categorizing individuals definitely promotes, you know, continues with a lot of barriers and hurdles. But from a different perspective, I think that if there's one thing that I would encourage any listener, especially those that have a few more levers to pull than others, that may have some policy pull or some funding capability, I would say dig deeper into the community. To really start to ask questions in your community about what works, what community feel keep kids safe, and also how foster parents can become part of the equation, a part of the solution, and also how parents can become extension of systems. I think that that is hopeful. And I also would just say that since we know better, how can we do better, right? I think we have the answers, meaning you listeners have the answers to those questions. And often those answers really reside right within your organization and or your community and those you serve.
Thanks again, Corey and Amanda, and to everyone out there listening in. We hope you enjoyed this inspiring conversation. Please check out our Voices from the Field resources, as well as our broader Questions from the Field resources at kc.org. Thank you.